Title of the seminar is Pitfalls of a Digital World. Some of us are digital immigrants. That's the title that's given to us. And some are digital natives. Digital immigrants are people born prior to 1990. And if you're born prior to 1990, you have grown up in two different worlds, really. And if you were born after 1990, you are a digital native. The whole new world of information and connectivity and the internet has been part of the whole of your life. If you're, under 28. So we want to think about this afternoon and this evening, what impact does that have on us? I want us to consider the weaknesses, not because I'm a technophobe, not because I don't like the internet and technology. I love it. I'm using my iPad for my speaking notes all weekend. I love my technology. But what I want us to consider the weaknesses, because the benefits are so often more obvious. And so I suppose a couple of questions to get us thinking. We'll not take discussion on these, but think for a moment, what are some of your biggest digital annoyances, some of your pet peeves, either about how it impacts you or how it impacts others? Just think it over. It may be the person who always has, thank you, their nose stuck in their phone. It may be people walking into you in the street because they've got their head down. It may be endless hours that people spend in computer games. It could be all sorts of things. It could be that your phone rings when you don't want it to ring. Somebody's phone went off just before the start of the funeral in Drumbog this afternoon. So you can all sorts of pet peeves and digital annoyances. Taking it up a level, then, there's annoyances, but then there's dangers. What do we think are some of the biggest dangers of the digital world? And perhaps instinctively we think that some of the biggest dangers are things like pornography. Or we think that it's things like somebody posing as a child on a chat room forum and interacting with your child, and there's all sorts of dangers there and child protection issues. And those are real dangers. But I think those obvious dangers cloak subtle dangers. And I want us to consider the internet from a different perspective this evening, thinking about what are the pitfalls of living in a digital world. It's too easy to think about the content that there is or the people that are using it. We want to look this evening at this in three parts, really. The first part is the big part. We're going to skip fairly quickly through the second part. And the third part, we'll spend some time on it. So the first part is what it does to us. The second part is what we do with it. And the third part is what we do so that it doesn't do all that to us. So what it does to us, what we do with it, and what we should do so that it doesn't do all that to us. I don't come at this from the position of being a technophobe. I like my technology, but we don't want to be so enamored with technology that we can only see the benefits and nothing else. We want not to be naive or gullible. And we want to consider its impact on us. And so we're going to essentially be thinking about hazards and how to avoid them. I'm taking, in a sense, a lot of the boons and the benefits for granted. Tim Challies, in an excellent book, The Next Story, which is out on the bookshelf. It's a little bit dated now. It was written, I think, in the early thousands. He says, technology wears its benefits on its sleeve while the drawbacks are buried deep within. Benefits on its sleeves, drawbacks buried deep within. So we want to go digging, and then we'll come up with some suggested solutions to the pitfalls. Oh, there's another quote from Challies. I hadn't time to work through the presentation just as much detail as I wanted this afternoon. Technology is biological. Let me just check this is in the right place. No, sorry. What the digital world does to us. That's our first main category. What the digital world does to us. No technology leaves us unchanged. A spade is technology. Before the spade, people were digging in the soil with their hands, and there was that connection to the very soil that they were digging in, and they could feel what the soil was like. They could feel its moisture. They could feel its looseness. They could feel what all sort of creatures were in there. A spade changed that. It changed the muscles that were developed. A digger then changes that again. It changes the muscles that aren't being developed anymore. A calculator is technology. And it changes our brains and how we think. All technology has an impact on us. It changes us, sometimes at a surface level, but often at a deep level. And it doesn't just change what we do or how much we can do, but it changes what we think and how we think. So the calculator allowed people to take on more and more complex calculations. Instead of using a slide rule or endless reams of paper, it allowed them to see a problem and think, this can be solved quickly and easily. It changed how they think. But more than that, it changes our brains. And here's this quote from Tim Challies. Technology is biological. Our brains actually change in response to new technologies. And then he writes, the brain of a person raised in the age of print, the person who learned from books and who read books in time of leisure or study, has a brain that is markedly different from a person who has learned primarily from images and who has watched videos in times of leisure or study. So our brains are impacted by this. We don't often think about this level that of impact that technology has on us. And we want to think about it at two levels. At the deep level, and then at the surface level. The deep level of our brains and the surface level socially. So first of all, at the deep level, and let me tell you a bit of why I'm interested in this. Several years ago, I had this growing niggle about my ability to remember and to make connections with clarity and sharpness. And I thought, well, Mark, you're just getting old. And then I thought, well, I have had probably about 20 general anesthetics in the course of my life. And I know that after those, my memory is shot to pieces. I could be mid-sentence and I would, what was I talking about? Lost the train of thought completely. I wondered, was that it? But then I began to wonder or to suspect that there was something else involved. And I began to wonder about my use of the internet, computer, email, e-books, if this was contributing to the disconnectedness and the fragmentedness of my thinking. And so, you know, I find myself working at something at my desk. It probably doesn't help that I am a little bit ADD. You know, I am easily distracted. I am a fidgeter. That is my nature. But there was something more going on. I'd be sitting working at my desk, and after a few minutes reading, I'd look up and I'd check my email. I'd follow a link, and then I'd return to reading. And then a few minutes later, I'd poke at something else on the internet. And that was just becoming more of a pattern. And then I came across a book by Nicholas Carr called The Shallows, How the Internet is Changing the Way We Think, Read and Remember. And Nicholas Carr, again, isn't somebody who hates technology. He loves it. But this is what he said. Let me see, hold on. Yep. Over the past few years, I've had an uncomfortable sense that someone or something has been tinkering with my brain, remapping the neural circuitry. And he goes on to say, reprogramming the memory. My mind isn't going so far as I can tell, but it's changing. I'm not thinking the way I used to think. I feel it most strongly when I'm reading. I'm starting to think, yes, this is me. So I used to find it easy to immerse myself in a book or a lengthy article. My mind would get caught up in the twists of the narrative or the turns of the argument, and I'd spend hours strolling through long stretches of prose. That rarely is the case anymore. Now my concentration starts to drift after a page or two. I get fidgety, lose the thread, I begin looking for something else to do. I feel like I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle. Maybe some of you have felt that. Maybe some of the younger people are thinking, what's he talking about? What is this deep reading? What is this long concentration? And maybe that's because your brain has been remapped and rewired and reprogrammed. Unconsciously to you, you haven't been aware of it. Carr continues, he says, I think I know what's going on. For well over a decade now, I've been spending a lot of time online, searching and surfing, and sometimes adding to the great databases of the internet. He talks about the benefits, but he highlights the costs. He says, the boons are real, but they come at a price. And then he has this great sentence. Once I was a scuba diver in the sea of words. Now I zip along the surface like a guy on a jet ski. And all this rang true for me. It's the same thing was going on in my own head. And then I read a little more in Tim Challey's book and found that we were indeed rewiring our minds. Our brains are incredible. There's another area to go and ponder at the glory of God in creation, how he has made our brains. They are plastic. They can be reprogrammed and rewired, and the neurons can be reassigned. They're incredible. But that works both ways. It can work negatively as well. And Challey's speaks of how we are rewiring our minds for distraction. Consider how often you check your phone, even though it hasn't buzzed or pinged or made any noise at all. You take it out and look at it, oh, nothing there. Bring it out again, even though nothing has happened, and you know nothing has happened from the last time. Mid-sentence, or in the middle of another task, we take out our phone and we look at it. But there's more to it than simple distraction. I found that I was less able to remember what I'd read, but I was perfectly able to remember where to find it. I could remember that I read it in such and such a book, and it was on the left-hand page, and it was halfway down, and was really, really good. Asked me what it was, and I just knew it was good. I knew where to find it. I could go to the book and pull it off the shelf and go, there it is. And I found that my brain had almost, I was treating my memory the way we treat things on the internet. There's so much stuff, so what do? You bookmark it. You log it away for future reference, or you know that you can go back into your history to find it, or you know you can go to Google, and Google will find it. You don't need to remember it, because Google will do it for you. You can outsource your memory. And so I was rewired for distraction, and I had outsourced my memory to the internet. And my use of the internet had in turn trained me just to remember where to find things, rather than the actual content. Even if it was in a book, a real book, a physical book, like this one, brilliant book. There's lovely stuff in it. I can tell you what I've highlighted and where it is, but actually at this particular moment, I can't remember more than it was really, really good. Marshall McLuhan, who is a guru in the field of technology, said this, the content of the medium, or of a medium, is just the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. The stuff you're looking at is just the juicy piece of meat to distract the watchdog of the mind. We can focus, as I said in the introduction, so much on the content. Are our young people looking at pornography? And pornography is a colossal problem, not just for young people, but for all ages of people. And go and speak to an elder or to your pastor or to me if that's an issue. It is an issue, a very live issue for many Christians. And those who aren't struggling with it may feel as if they've got nothing to worry about the internet. But here is Marshall McLuhan saying, it's not simply that people watch wrong stuff. That's the juicy piece of meat. Your mind is being impacted and you don't even know it. When I was preparing to give this at Gold Coast Conference, on the way to the conference, I read an article that really was quite frightening. It was talking about game developers and app developers. And one of the things that they talked about, and here's a quote from it. Let me give it to you. Dopamine Labs, Ramsey Brown, said, "Since we figured out to some extent how these pieces of the brain that handle addiction work, people have figured out how to juice them up further and how to bake that information into apps." So we know how addiction works. We've seen the parts of the brain that light up. We know what parts of we know what to do in games and apps to make those parts of the brain light up. And so much of gaming is now being driven by psychologists who are putting into the programming of games and apps things that light up the addictive centers of our brain. They talk about brain hacking. I glanced back over the article this afternoon. They talk about weaponizing persuasion. And they talk about each person having a persuasion profile. Young people, you know that you have a persuasion profile held on the internet, gleaned from your surfing, gleaned from apps you're using, and people developing the apps are seeking to build that knowledge so that they know how to persuade you to do things. Now, this article wasn't one of those sensational, crazy tunes, loony tunes, places written by some lunatic. It was somebody who works as a psychologist dealing with people coming to them and saying, well, in some cases saying, my kids are, going off the rails. They're addicted to this stuff. And it's because that's precisely how apps and games are being designed. So they know it impacts our minds, and they're working specifically at it. Now, this really matters because Paul tells us that we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. Our minds are to be mastered by us, by God. We, under God, we are to be masters of our minds. I'm not being alarmist, but I want us to be alert. I want to be an alertist. Calvin Troup, who's the president of Geneva College in our American sister denomination, said, this isn't a matter for panic. This is the world that we were created to be in. God is sovereign. He has made us to be in this world, so we don't need to despair or panic or to be, unplugging everything around us. We just need to be aware of the pitfalls. So, thinking about the deep level of the brain, let me give four of the consequences of internet and mobile technology and smartphones and the impact they can have on our brains. First of all, there's wired for distraction. Wired for distraction. In the past, if people wanted to distract you, they had to physically come to your house, ring the doorbell, and then later on, perhaps they could ring your phone, and that was about it. They had to physically be present. Now, we've got all sorts of summoning devices, interrupting devices. We've got the ping of email. We've got the ping of WhatsApp, the ping of phone text messages, and Facebook and Snapchat and Messenger and Instagram. Ping, ping, ping. We're wired for distraction. I think it probably depends on our job. Some of us are perhaps more wired for distraction than others because there's some jobs, like perhaps a teacher, where you can't just bring your phone out all the time and keep looking at it. So that's a good thing. But those of us who can sit at a desk and be working at that sort of thing or out and about doing things or about the house and doing housework, and we're free to pull out our phone and look at it, we're being trained to be distracted. And that's what I found. After a few minutes reading, I'd look up and check my email, I'd follow a link, and then I'd return to reading. David Murray, I think it's in his book Reset, talks about mental whiplash. You're on this topic, and then you're on this, and then you're on this. And any wonder our brains become overloaded. And then you're reading an article, and you're following the flow of the argument, and it's really good. And then there's something that's a link, and you click the link, and you're away off somewhere else. And then maybe you come back to the article, or maybe you don't. What odds? You know, well, there's a lot of odds because you're training yourself to be distracted. And Nicholas Carr, in his book, The Shallow, says, Google is quite literally in the business of distraction. They generate money from you clicking on links. They want you to be distracted. They're not one bit interested in the content of the article. They want you to click stuff because clicking is money. Nicholas Carr again says, whenever we turn on our computer, we are plugged into an ecosystem of interruption technologies. Interruption technologies. And your brain becomes wired to expect it. That sensation of pulling out your phone to look at it, even when it hasn't pinged. Our brains expect to be distracted. I think it's about every 7 minutes. And many of us now live in what's known as a state of continuous partial attention. I thought, yeah, that's me. Continuous partial attention. Part of our mind is always tuned in to incoming communications. Alert to it. Status updates, tweets, mobile phone messages, whatever it is. And we're not given to the task in hand. And often, when that communication isn't there, how do you feel? We feel deprived. And so we do check our phones when there's nothing has happened. And it leads to a fragmentation of thought. So this is the first thing that happens at the level of the brain. We're wired for distraction. And then the second thing is we're overloaded for remembering. Overloaded for remembering. We flick from one subject to another, Snapchat to Facebook. We skim an article, we go back to a conversation. You look at your phone and look at how many apps are open at any one time. I suspect maybe for some of the older folk here, you're wondering what on earth I'm talking about. I talk of apps and you're maybe wondering, you know, what do you mean they're all open at one time? Well, just be thankful that you're not being so badly distracted. But there, for those of us who are app savvy, this is what's going on. We know stuff about a million topics, but only a millimeter deep. Way back in the last millennium, in the year of 1997, a youthful, beardless Peter McKelvey said to me he was buying a new computer with a 2 gig hard drive. And I said, Pete, wise up. Nobody needs a hard drive that big. A 2 gig hard drive. I think currently I have I think about 12 terabytes of hard drive on my desk. That's, what's that, 6,000 times more than Pete was looking for. David Murray says that we face a bombardment of 74 gigabytes of data every day from all forms of media. So do you see what it means whenever we're overloaded for remembering? And you see the way our brain works is that in its downtime, it takes what we've been thinking about and it sorts it and it files it and it organizes it and it makes connections between things that we're not even aware of down at the subconscious level, and it puts everything in the right place. And that's why sometimes when you're maybe out on your bike or you're, in my case, out swimming, and when I come out of the pool, suddenly, out of nowhere, I've got an outline for the passage that was perplexing me before I went swimming. Or before you've gone for a run, before you've gone for a walk. You weren't actively thinking about it, but suddenly it's become clear. It's because that's how your brain works. In its downtime, it's doing all those things. Now, if you're continually bombarding it, do you see what happens? It's got no downtime for it to be filing things here and there in all the right locations and making the connections between topics. And so we don't remember stuff because our brains are constantly working. We become adept at forgetting and inept at remembering. Again, Nicholas Carr. And then there's another consequence to that. This overloading and inability to remember is that we become anxious and stressed because our brain is constantly looking at things and making decisions. This app, that app, this message, click this link, or don't click that link. And decision overload causes stress. This is the sort of thing that's going on at a deep level in our minds. Thirdly, we become, as I've mentioned, addicted to ping, addicted to notification, addicted to those little red blobs that tell us that two people have liked our Facebook post. We've got more likes on Snapchat or Instagram. And somehow the incoming signal and the touch of a smartphone, the tactile nature of a smartphone technology, converges to give a release of a chemical in our systems, a pleasure-producing cousin of adrenaline called dopamine. And we actually become addicted to it. That's what happens. And so we do become addicted to the little red circle on Facebook or on WhatsApp or on Instagram, the little heart, the retweet function. We like to see it and we go looking for it. And this is what happens. Addicted to ping. Ask yourself, what are you like, young people particularly, I suppose, without social media? Do you find yourself a bit gloomy, a bit unsure, a bit edgy? It's maybe a sign that we have a craving. We're not quite sure what it is, but this is what it is. And then fourthly, we become shallowed in our thinking. Because we're overloaded, we can't think deeply about things. And again, we have been given a book, a deep book, a rich book. We live in this colossally rich world that we were thinking about this morning. We are made for deep thought. And this is one of the complications or impacts of continuous internet usage, is we become shallow in our thinking. Nicholas Carr again says, when the load exceeds our mind's ability to store and process the information, we are unable to retain the information or to draw the connections with the information already stored in our long-term memory, and our ability to learn suffers, and our understanding remains shallow. In other words, we end up with not enough brain power to think deeply, not enough silence to think deeply, not enough undistractedness to think deeply. One guy has a great phrase. He talks about we become pancake people. I would love to be a pancake person. I'd just love pancakes, but that's not what he's talking about. He says, we become pancake people, spread wide and thin as we connect with that vast network of information accessed by the mere touch of a button. So, this can all be summed up in one word, overloaded. Overloaded. So that's what in the digital world does to us. We're spending most of our time here, so don't panic if you're looking at the time. I'm panicking enough for us. The deep level of the brain. But then at the surface level socially, and this is a lot more obvious, this is the stuff that we see happening around us. I'm aware that I'm flagging up lots of dangers. And I suppose maybe for the young folks who don't know, I am really a real technophile. I love technology. My degree's in architecture. I love design. And because I can't draw for peanuts, I was one of the first people to use 3D modeling whenever it really kicked off away back in the 1990s. I love technology, so don't think that this is just some old fogey having a rant. But here's what it does socially to us. It shallows not just our minds and our thinking, but our connections, our relationships. It may be less obvious to us as well, but it shallows the impact that we have on people and our friendships and our connections with them. What impact does digital communication have? Well, it means that we become less comfortable with actually talking with each other. You know, phones aren't actually used for speaking anymore. They're used for messaging. There's a great book called Alone Together, not a Christian book, a secular book by Sherry Turkle, and she quotes a 17-year-old young person, or sorry, 16-year-old young person, who says, when you text, you have more time to think about what you're writing. On the telephone, too much might show. And then another one says that one day he might, not now, but sometime soon, force himself to talk on the phone. He says, that would be a good thing because I could teach myself to have a conversation. For later in life, I'll need to learn how to have a conversation. We've regressed to the telegraph. So we have, the sending of message. Remember the telegraph messages sent, from far off countries, arrived safely, stop. Everything good, stop. Send money, stop. That was 1895, or a text message from 1895. But we're back there. And one of the things that has happened, and lots of studies, I'll not give you all the details of it, but lots of studies have shown that a measure of the empathy that students at university have for fellow human beings has dropped between 2010 and 10 years previously in the year 2000. Or another study showed that it had, in between the generation of the 1980s and the 1990s and the generation of today, today's generation scored about 40% lower in empathy than their counterparts. It's because we're losing connectedness. And technology always distances us from something and desensitizes us to something. And so in the moment that it's actually seeming to help us do something, it is desensitizing us. Think of the person using a digger. They're desensitized to the ground. They're desensitized to what's in the ground. Maybe they'll slice through cables that they wouldn't have sliced through were they using a spade or their hands. But it does give them great advantages. To dig. Technology, the phone, the iPad, the tablet, all of that gives us great advantages to be connected with people. But by the same measure, it also hinders our connectedness to people. And we need to be aware of that. We end up, our tools end up numbing whatever part of the body they amplify, Nicholas Carr writes. So there's a sense of a shallowing of our relationships. There's a sense of detachment that comes. The detachment, that's the detachment. I've run those two together. The shallowness of the connection, shallowness of relation, and a sense of detachment where we do become detached from the people around us. That was the loss of empathy and that aspect of it. And then thirdly, there's a sense of busyness that comes to us, a sense of importance. We are all overscheduled and addicted to social and professional busyness. This guy writes in, I think it's in a, it was in a book that was being quoted in the New York Times, we are all overscheduled and addicted to social and professional busyness. This guy writes, busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness. In other words, I've got so much going on in my life. Look at how busy my Twitter feed is, how busy my Facebook feed is, how busy my Instagram feed is. People are loving all the stuff I'm doing. I must be really important. Obviously, your life cannot be silly or trivial or meaningless if you're so busy, completely booked, in demand every hour of the day. I'm busy, therefore I must be important. I'm connected, therefore I am somebody. So these are the levels where it's impacting us socially. And then the fourth one is we're burdened by social pressure. There's another book with the superb title, if you're into your grammar, you'll get the play on words. iPod, YouTube, We Play. Remember the Wii? W-I-I. iPod, YouTube, We Play. And Brent Latham says, We are anxious about relevance, vulnerable to hype, and addicted to novelty. The fear of missing out. Now, this is all happening inside us. This is the level, the social level. We're made to be social beings. God has made us in His image because He is social in that sense. He exists in glorious triunity. One of the things that Mike Reeves brings out in this book, The Good God. We are made for that. That's our glory. And yet this impacts it. Not just in helpful ways, which it does. But remember, we're flagging up the dangers that lurk below the surface. So, we have one word that sums up this section. We are overspread. Overloaded at the deep level of the brain and overspread socially. So, that's what the internet is doing to us. Not just the internet, but Wi-Fi, wireless connectedness, messages coming in, the digital world. That's what it's doing. Now, we're going to rattle through this next section because this is the obvious section. We do with the digital world. And really, I think I am just going to rattle through it very quickly. There are those two levels again of the surface level, the obvious, and the deep level. And let's just flick through the surface level first at the surface level and at the deep level. The surface level, what we do with the internet, there is what we take in with our eyes. And the things that desensitize us to anything else, that make us think that life is cheap, that it's okay for people to be mocked and ridiculed, the things that are there, and it's not just pornography, but all sorts of things that desensitize us to God's standards. Or the things that we look at that make us discontent. Instagram world, you know, and all those carefully posed photographs that look casually taken. That are all so fake but look so real, that make us wish our life was like their life. Then there's our speech. It's trickier. Commenting on Facebook or tweeting, and it's so quick to fire something off. And we need to watch our speech. That's a whole subject in itself. We want to engage Christianly. Does this encourage Christ-likeness? Does this display Christ-likeness? So at the surface level. And then there's at the deep level. And again, we want to rattle through these pretty quickly. Identity. What we do with the internet. Are we getting our identity from the internet? The old philosopher said, I think, therefore I am. And then somebody's changed it to, I connect, therefore I am. And then I suggest we can go a step further and say, my status was liked, my tweet was liked or retweeted, therefore I am somebody. Where do we get our identity from? How much of my moods are determined by how my social media is going? Is social media more significant in my life than Jesus? Do I feel better because somebody has liked my photograph on Instagram? Somebody has messaged me on Snapchat? Somebody has liked my post on Facebook? Do I feel more significant because of that than I do because Almighty God has loved me from before the creation of the world? Honestly, which one is it? So, where does our identity come from? Jesus Christ is the fullness of Him who fills everything in every way. What gives me my fullness? Christ or social media? What do we do with the internet? At the deeper level, identity and time. The global average is 2.25 hours every day connected digitally to others. One writer says we are in fact living in parallel universes. And we can spend all our time in a parallel universe. I'll not say anything more on this. It's just, where does our time go? How much of our time is devoted to social media? Think of what we could be doing with the time. So, that's a quick run through of the the more obvious aspect of what we do with the digital world, our engagement with it. But I do believe it is far more significant that we consider its engagement of us when we're not even aware of its engagement with us. What it does to us. That's far more significant. And then we want to make some application now. What we do with our digital world so that it doesn't master us. So, having heard what you've heard, and maybe wanting to go away and think about it a bit more, what do you think, I'm not asking for feedback, but just think about this, what do you think you ought to change about your mobile phone use, your tablet or your computer, and feel unable or afraid to do so? I want us to think about a couple of key Bible verses, a couple of key rules of thumb that Paul gives in century 1 that are really useful in century 21. Everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. The iPad is permissible. The phone is permissible. The computer's permissible. Snapchat's permissible, just about. Instagram's permissible. Twitter is permissible. Facebook is permissible. But is it beneficial? And yes, it can be. But we want to make sure that we are benefiting from it. But this second one, rule of thumb, everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. I will not be mastered by it. And I think this evening what I've wanted you to see is that we can be more mastered by a thing than we have ever grasped. And there is a whole bevy of developers and programmers and psychologists out there who have a vested interest in mastering you, in remolding you. And actually, one of the phrases in that article, if I remember correctly, is reshaping your personality. I just find that frightening. We are to be reshaped by the Holy Spirit and made into the likeness of Christ. And yet, as we are poking around and surfing, a bunch of godless pagans are reprogramming our personality, unbeknownst to us. And they call it brain hacking. And these aren't deviants out there who are the sort of hackers that we think of, who are trying to steal money from your bank accounts or telling you they're a Nigerian prince who has given you $4 billion. Not those sort of people, but these are app developers. Now, maybe if you're an app developer here, I don't have a pick against you. I'm using a very good app at the minute to track my time usage. I think it's brilliant. But there's a big industry behind some of this stuff, some of the popular stuff, and we need to be aware of it. Yes, there are lots of apps that are beneficial, but we want to question, are we being mastered by them? We don't want to worship the internet. We don't want to let it define us. We don't want our technology to master us. And so I've got, as we close, six principles for us. Cultivate Sabbath. Cultivate Sabbath. Sabbath, I said this morning, is meant to be ascent into heaven as we come to worship God. A day where we can luxuriate, as it were, in the presence of God with the people of God. So let's cultivate the Sabbath day as a day of rest. A digital Sabbath, maybe even. Now, some families use it as a day to Skype family members far away. Fine, brilliant. My daughters use it. They benefit tremendously from being able to Skype their friends in this congregation. I'm not against that. That is a great use of technology to benefit us on the Lord's Day. But why is it sometimes when I'm looking at Facebook, I'm seeing people that I know who are otherwise godly Christians and godly Christians, older people and young people, clicking and liking things that are nothing to do with the Sabbath day? It's just so easy that we forget ourselves. There's times I find myself nearly doing it too. I think, no, no, put that away. We need a digital Sabbath more than we realize. I'm going on holidays the rest of this week, and I was rather pleased that the house that I've booked doesn't have Wi-Fi. It's like, yes, happy days. I will be forced. I don't really like it, but I know that I'm forcing myself to give my brain a rest. So there's going to be a bit of a digital Sabbath for most of the days of this week until I can get to other friends' houses and log in again, because I'm really weak. But Katy Perry, that well-known theologian and philosopher of society, said, "I wish there was a thing like Sabbath, a worldwide day where we're not on our phones. I'd love it if the world implemented an actual day of real rest." Rest, we need to rest our brains, we need to rest our memories, we need to cultivate our relationship with God. Cultivate a Sabbath on the Sabbath day, but also cultivate other Sabbaths from digital input. Say with Paul, this is beneficial, but it won't master me. I will be a master of my devices. So cultivate Sabbath. Cultivate undistractedness. Picasso said, without great solitude, no serious work is possible. Think about that. Without great solitude, no serious work is possible. You know, poor Leonardo da Vinci was a distracted man, but he got distracted with brilliance. You know, he'd be painting a portrait of somebody's face and realized that he didn't know quite how many muscles were in the neck. So he would go away and he would dissect a corpse and he would find out where the muscles were. And then he would draw it up in his notebook, and then he would think, that's really fascinating the way that bone goes. And then he would get distracted and he would investigate more stuff. And he was doing useful stuff. But our distractedness, you know, his solitude allowed him to do serious work. Even his distraction was good distraction. We benefited from it. But you know, the distractedness that we face is a problem. And we need to cultivate undistractedness. 2 minutes of silence is more relaxing than listening to relaxing music. David Murray makes that claim in his book Reset, and he footnotes it and backs it up. If we are in danger or have already rewired our brains for distraction, the good news is that our brains are plastic. They can be rewired and remodeled, and we can cultivate new habits, and we can practice undistractedness. Now, let me quickly give you 3 periods of undistractedness. 1, your morning devotions. Make sure you leave your device away from your Bible reading. Don't read it on your phone if you can help it. Or put it in airplane mode. Do not disturb mode. No, that's not even good enough. Put it in airplane mode. Switch off the Wi-Fi signal so that you can read God's word undistractedly. I am weak here. I'm really weak. I have to do my devotions in the first room I come to when I come down the stairs. I leave my phone and my iPad, for the most part, in the study, around the other side of the house, so that I'm not near them when I'm coming to do my devotions, because I'm hopeless. I will lift my phone, and the next thing will be, well, there's messages come in overnight, and there's something on Facebook I need to reply to. I'm no use. I'm weak. I should be alone with Christ, not with my device, not with my phone. Our best times should be given to our priorities. So, undistractedness in your devotions, undistractedness in your work. Studies show that office work is far more productive, not simply when phones are turned off and left on the desk, or left face down on the desk, when they're left outside the office. More work is done. So get the phone out of the work environment. And then the third key area is before bed. Sleep is a gift from God. And yet screen time robs us of the gift that God gives. It disrupts and disturbs our sleep. Do you know that it takes an hour for your head to wind down after digital stimulation. It takes an hour for your head to wind down after digital stimulation. Scrolling messages at night before you go to bed. Your brain is firing off all sorts of chemicals that need to dissipate. We need to cultivate undistractedness. Thirdly, we need to cultivate thought. In a world where thought is discounted, where protracted thought is difficult because we're constantly being interrupted, and Google is in the business of interruption, it doesn't want deep thought, for deep thought doesn't keep us clicking. We need to work on depth. So let me encourage you to force your mind to work. Pick up a book that's a little bit harder to read. If you're struggling to read it, make notes. Summarize the book. Stuart Gamble and I were talking about that last night, summarizing that brilliant book of Professor Leakey's, The Cross He Bore. That's a dense book. That's a book to go and read. It doesn't even have to be a Christian book. Read other books that are harder for you to read. Or even sit down and listen to a lecture or something on YouTube. Use it for its benefits. So that, and keep at it, keep focused on it. Make notes on it. Cultivate thought. Some of you, there's a book out there in the bookstall. It's a superb book for delighting in Christ. But it's hard going. The Shadow of Calvary by Hugh Martin. I remember reading parts of it whenever I was a young person here at Trinity, and at one point I gave up and counted rather how many lines he took for a complete sentence. One of them was 14 lines long. You know, that will cultivate your love for Jesus, but it will also cultivate focused thought. Work on memorizing chunks of Scripture. God has given us a brain. Palmer Robertson was speaking at a minister's conference, and he was saying he had been speaking at a conference in Africa, and it challenged them to memorize Romans 8, and he said, there's a study Bible here for whoever can memorize Romans 8, the first. That was the nighttime address to the conference. First thing the next morning, a young girl comes up to him and says, I've memorized Romans 8. And she repeated it word perfect. She had learned it overnight, and she got her study Bible. How much stronger we could be if God's Word was lodged in our minds, percolating in our brains, as our brain is filing it and connecting things to it and making connections subconsciously. You know, our brains are phenomenal, and we need to cultivate thought and cultivate face-to-face. Giving precedence to presence. I think that's Calvin Troup used that phrase. It's vital for our health, our mental health. It's vital for the church. There's a big long quote here from Neil Postman. We'll not worry about it. Another one from Nicholas Carr. But we want to cultivate connectedness with real people face to face. Meet up with people. Spend time with them. As a church, as Christians, we're to be different. We must be people who honor those who are made in the image of God by speaking and listening and giving full attention, just as God does to us. And in a world of dying conversation and increasing loneliness and more disconnectedness, the church has something glorious to give as well as the gospel. We've got fellowship. But let's make our churches places not just where there's vertical connectedness, but there's horizontal connectedness. And when people come in, they see that we are really interested in them. And it's not just a Lord's Day thing, but there's a connectedness, there's a face-to-faceness throughout the week. Yes, WhatsApp's brilliant for prayer requests and for arranging things like meeting up face-to-face. So let's cultivate face-to-face. Let's cultivate did we lose one? Yes, cultivate our identity in Christ. Particularly our young people. Don't get your identity from likes and retweets and all sorts of, you know, people commenting on your stuff on the internet. You get your identity from knowing Jesus Christ. You are loved by the triune God. You're designed by Him to know Him, and you are designed to live forever and to enjoy Him forever. And that's what makes you unique and special. Get your identity from Him. Don't get your identity from some, as I've described them before, some sack of dust. That's what we are. We're sacks of dust, causing a little red circle to light up on a plastic screen in front of you. Don't get your identity from that. Get it from the eternal God who set His love on you from before those hills and those sky and stars were made. And then finally, cultivate grace. Cultivate grace. This has got to flavor all that we do and all our interactions. We don't want to be mastered by anything so that we're short and sharp with people. And that's what this makes us often. And our interactions on Facebook or on Twitter are terse because we just want to get the thing into the phone and send it off. And we say things we wouldn't say face to face. And in a world where there's sharpness and shortness and slamming people and slapping them down, let's be different. Let's cultivate grace and cultivate a gentleness and let our words be seasoned with salt and full of grace as we interact in a digital environment. The flaw in a digital world is that we become digital in our thinking. And everything's good or bad, like or dislike, hate or love. Instead of there being nuance and wisdom and grace, we become black and white and harsh. So, as we finish, there's, some resources I want us to look at. I want to recommend to you The Shallows by Nicholas Carr, Alone Together by Shelley Turkle, are secular books, really good. The Next Story, a little bit, only fractionally dated by Tim Challies, but really worth the read. It's on the bookstall. Reset by David Murray in terms of, that's a more general book on looking after our bodies and our minds and in a busy world. And then there's that one with the winner for the best title, iPod, YouTube, We Play by Brent Latham. Calvin Troup, in giving a similar seminar at a conference I was at, said, trust God for the important things of life. Don't trust your digital connections with others. God will free us to use these technologies as tools as long as we regard them as tools.